68 that is remembered by many as his "I've been to the mountaintop" speech. Our guest this morning, Isaiah J. Poole, has written a blog in which he talks about this last speech and reminds us, those of us who may forget the full legacy of Martin Luther King, that Dr. King was someone who was not only an advocate for justice for some people, but for all people. We are reminded this day and this age that the cause for justice continues, and that we must remember to continue to advocate for justice wherever we see it is missing. Today, in our era, where there is much that is going on in terms of the rights of workers and the continued struggle here in this nation in various states, it is perhaps appropriate that today we remember the legacy of Martin Luther King and the legacy that we must continue to uphold and encourage. That is one of justice for all of all people. Mr. Poole is the executive editor of TomPaine.com. He is a journalist for over 25 years. Previously, he's written for the Congressional Quarterly and is also a founding member of the Washington Association of Black Journalists and the National Lesbian Gay Journalists Association. Thank you for joining us this morning, Mr. Poole. We will try to continue. I think we might have lost our microphone with Mr. Poole, but we will continue our conversation. On the night before he was assassinated, Dr. King spoke before an audience, in which he reminded his audience that the cause for justice must continue. He said, in part, these words. He reminded us that he of the many people in the past, of all the ages in terms of justice, and reminded that he was an advocate for justice. He talked about the human rights revolution, a words that might have been strange for those ears in 1968, but which in years since then has become a marching order for many people. And so we are reminded, as in this last speech, as he took a glance off history throughout the history and was reminded that we must continue to work for justice. And I think we have Mr. Poole with us right now. Good morning, Mr. Poole.
Good morning.
Hi, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Great. Today is April 4th, and as you are well aware that throughout the nations that there are rallies and things that are happening, and we thought it would be appropriate for you to join us this morning to talk about not only the legacy of Martin Luther King, but to help our audience to get a picture of not only the man and his movement, but why it is important for us to remember him and how we might appropriate some of his concerned for justice in this modern era. Why do you think it is important for people throughout the nation to rally on this day?
Well, I think the thing to remember about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was that he was not just a moral leader or a spiritual leader, but he was also a person who was challenging us to take those moral principles and those spiritual principles and actually make those work in the real world. So these weren't just theories or nice things that, nice principles that he was espousing. I mean, these were transformative principles that he was really fighting to say that, we need to see actual change in the lives of ordinary people. The other thing to remember about Dr. King, and I think is particularly relevant today, is his movement was, as everyone knows, was pivoting in the late 1960s. Into a call for economic justice and economic equity. And that was not just a civil rights issue. In other words, poor Appalachian whites at that time, other people who were at the bottom of the economic ladder, King was really fighting for the kind of transformation in the economy so that everyone would have a way up that ladder into middle-class prosperity. And what we've seen over the last decade is that ladder has crumbled. It has gotten to the point where many people can't climb it.
Mm-hmm.
And the attacks on public workers, in particular in Madison, Wisconsin, and in Columbus, Ohio, and in some of the other states around the country where conservative governors are trying to use public employees as a way to close their budget deficits, in many ways parallels the fight that King was waging in Memphis, in the sense that you were talking there, as well as in Madison, of public employees who are being disrespected and who are being abused and who are being made out to be scapegoats. And I think it's important to say that workers should have dignity, work should have dignity, and those who are at the bottom of our economic ladder, we should fight to make sure that they have a way up.
You mentioned those words in terms of the dignity of workers, and I recall that one of the sayings of that last campaign, it might be adapted today to change the language a little bit, but was the sign that people wore was, "I am a man."
Yes.
And that, could you say something about the position of garbage workers in Memphis at that time, and say something more about the struggle they face at that particular point in time, and why it was so important for them to organize?
Well, there were a number of issues. There's an article on our site, by the way, which I would encourage everyone to read. It's called Dangerous Unselfishness. It's written by a member of our online team, Terrence Heath. And that post goes a little bit on ourfuture.org. And that post goes a little bit into some of the history of the garbage worker strike and links to some resources that people can look into further. But, you know, there was a fundamental racism issue in terms of black workers being forced to work in conditions that were far worse than conditions of white workers. There was a pay issue, which black workers were receiving less pay. One of the precipitating incidents touched off the strike, in fact, was a situation in which a couple of African-American garbage workers were actually killed because the only way that they could protect themselves from a serious storm was to get inside the back of the garbage truck where the trash is being thrown. And they were back there trying to shelter themselves from the rain, and somehow the trash compactor mechanism was activated, and they were crushed. And the fact that that was just about the only option that those workers had to protect themselves, and they were crushed in that way, that became a symbol of the bad working conditions that those workers faced and was a precipitating moment in that strike. The mayor of Memphis at that time was very much like Scott Walker in a way. Mm-hmm. He was very intransigent, very inflexible, very insensitive to the workers' plight. And it took King going down there, and it took the labor unions, AFSCME and others, to fight over a matter of several months to resolve that conflict.
Didn't it also take federal pressure?
Well, it did take federal pressure, absolutely. Forgive me for not knowing all of the federal actions that were taking place in Memphis at that time, but you know, clearly, you know, if you think about what that period was like, I was 16 years old at the time, living here in Washington, D.C. When King died, within hours, Washington, D.C. and a number of other cities exploded. There were stores on fire a block from my house where I was living at the time. And we had just this explosion of rage and anger, which resulted in some federal action to try to begin to address the problems. Now, we all know the history after that. There was a bit of momentum that was lost over time. President Nixon was in the White House. Now he looks like a progressive president, but then in the context of that particular time, he wasn't. And I think much of what he did, he was dragged into kicking and screaming. But there was a recognition that we had gotten to a point where these problems could not be resolved, could not be avoided.
We are speaking this morning with Isaiah Poole, who authored a recent blog entitled From Memphis to Madison, the April 4th Stand for Economic Justice. You are listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil.
I'm Celeste Carey, and we'd invite your calls at 503-231-8187. I've also got our website up and running, so we can take your blog calls or your electronic calls as well, either at moretalkradio@gmail.com, or you could hit us at kboo.fm, More Talk Radio. We'll go to Chad. Thank you for holding. Good morning. Good morning, Chad. Okay, I'm not hearing anything. All right, well, we're back. We're back, and we're speaking with Isaiah Poole. We've been talking about the subsequent meltdown that came when public workers' needs were not addressed. And you talked a little bit about how there was a nexus between the need for organizing, especially for minority workers, for black workers, and their entrance into unions. I want to talk a little bit more about that, because one of the things that we're missing, I think, when we talk about unions is the fact that even though there has been a legacy of racism and discrimination within unions, unions recognize that they have some of the historical roots and the contributions of immigrants and of minorities and of blacks here in this country. And that is where we find our strongest allies in terms of opportunities for employment for minorities in this country.
Well, that's absolutely true, and you're right. There's been this incredible level of tension around race in the union movement over the decades. But I'm reminded of the United Auto Workers, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, the auto industry became a major employer of African Americans after the Great Migration northward, and the United Auto Workers became a significant ally in King's civil rights struggle, for example. So you have, you know, that history. The problem today, as you know, is that union, the power of unions and the percentage of people represented by unions is way down from where it was up through the 1970s. The decline of the manufacturing sector has devastated union membership, and as well as the anti-union policies that have been enacted through conservative administrations. The National Labor Relations Board, for example, does not go aggressively after anti-union campaigns mounted by private industry. But we see millions of dollars spent by business to mischaracterize union organizing efforts. So we have that imbalance in place. And the result of that, I think, for working class people of all races, is that workers are disempowered. You take what management dictates, or you don't have anything at all.
We also have what I would call a second wave, similar to that in the early 70s, where there had been gains made through the efforts of unions and organizing, such that people thought, well, I don't really need to join a union because there are higher wages, and we've got jobs that maybe don't seem on the surface to have the need for organizing. And so in, I'd say, especially the latter part of the 80s, you started seeing some fall off because more people thought, well, I'm okay, especially with the dot-com boom, the advent of internet business and all of the interrelated business opportunities that presented themselves.
Well, that turned out to be a fallacy, though.
Well, it turned out to be a fallacy because a lot of those same people needed to organize. But it seemed that we had a major drop-off, as you mentioned, in terms of people's interests. Well, that seemed to be another period where we had drop-off. And it just kind of goes to show that one of the perennial truths of labor in this country and maybe just the world around is organization is key. People united can't be divided.
Well, exactly. I think the union movement has learned some lessons. I think they were slow on the uptake on for example, the assault on the union vote rules.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We saw a massive AstroTurf campaign back during the Bush era of the ads against the union bosses, and they want to have secret ballots and all of this kind of thing. Well, this was all, you know, poppycock, but you didn't see you certainly didn't see an ad-for-ad campaign saying, look, what you're hearing on the other side is false. Unions are beneficial to workers, and these are the benefits that union workers get. And, oh, by the way, when we've played the game by their rules, working class and middle class incomes have actually stagnated over the past decade.
You are listening to More Talk Radio. Our guest this morning is Isaiah Paul. Today is the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King, and we are talking this morning about the connection between the struggle for justice in 1968 and the continuing struggle for economic justice here today. We invite your calls and your participation, and we have a couple of calls. Let's go to Chad. Good morning, Chad.
Welcome back.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm sorry, I think I got cut off there earlier this morning. I just have a few minutes here because I'm actually getting ready to go to work. But I did want to let all your listeners know that the AFL-CIO is actually staging a rally this afternoon at 5:30 in Director Park in downtown Portland.
Yes.
And we invite everyone from the community to come out and be a part of our rally.
Not just union workers, everybody.
everyone in the community. This is honoring Dr. King's dream, and we're hoping to keep the dream alive. And we do recognize that that economic empowerment was a big part of his dream. And unions are definitely on the ropes right now. Again, I only have a few seconds here, but I just wanted to let you know that we are doing that this afternoon. And we would love to have everyone in the community come out. And all of your listeners are for sure invited.
So 5:30, and where's the location again?
Director Park in downtown Portland.
And I believe that's 4th and Yamhill, Southwest?
I believe so. It's about two blocks, I want to say two blocks west of Pioneer Square.
Okay, great. Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chad. And Mr. Poole, you noted in your article that there are grassroots activities throughout the nation today. Is that correct?
Yes. On our site, ourfuture.org, we link to about to the official We Are One website. And as of this morning, there are about 1,000 events around the country. Mm-hmm. There are several here in Washington, D.C. One of the ones that I'm hoping to attend features Michael K. Honey, who has just authored a book which goes through the economic speeches mm-hmm. that King made over the years mm-hmm. and talks about the economic justice aspect of his work.
Excellent.
Thank you.
I think it's time, and I think it's appropriate, as so many people misinterpret or deliberately skew the image and the work of the justice movement in the 60s and 70s to make linkage to the struggles that continues today. And the We Are One website links can link you up to many activities that are organized about workers' rights and economic justice issues today. Let's go to our next caller.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Cecil.
Good morning.
Mr. Poole, wonderful discussion. I think it's so important to talk about the late Dr. Martin Luther King in relations to his extremely wide social justice platform, economic justice, and indeed his role as a powerful and outspoken anti-war figure. It's a shame that there's been this violence to and the diminution of the legacy of Mr. Martin Luther King over the decades, a sort of co-optation where we got to a point where every year we roll out the I Have a Dream speech or a few excerpts and everyone goes down to the town square and the kids get finger painted, face painted, and so forth. And we all celebrate it with our, and so how Martin Luther King has been effectively, in some sense, reduced to this sort of this relatively benign figure that where we only talk about his considerable achievement in his work towards the civil rights and racial justice in the United States. It's a real shame. And in relation to the question, I guess here's my question. In relation to the question of economic justice, I have to wonder what Mr. Martin Luther King would say today. We have a situation right now, a very difficult situation, where we have the amazing Barack Obama presidency, a president who has, in some sense, symbolized a sort of a realization of at least a symbolic dream of the civil rights era that a black person in the country could, on his own merits, achieve the highest political office, and yet, we see a situation in time of incredible economic peril. We see the first black president of the United States has essentially packed his presidency with members of a who's list of corporate America, from Goldman Sachs to Monsanto to GE, and right on down the list. And we also are talking about a presidency which has gone back on the word to renegotiate NAFTA, is giving support for the Korean Free Trade Act, mm-hmm. and has continuously dragged its feet at labor and refused to make any movement on the Employee Free Choice Act, which is probably the largest single wish of labor in the United States over the last 30 years. And my question is this. We can see that there's a degree of cowardly and complicit conformitarianism in the White House. We have a situation which a black man has proven that he can become president of the United States, but there's a trail of a demonstration of the willingness to serve the interests of rich white men. And my question is, do we run the danger of being blinded presidency, the reality, and how can we go beyond this? How can we go forward and make meaningful demands upon a president that of such contradictions?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Poole.
The first thing I would say is that always remember that the relationship between President Lyndon Johnson and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a tense relationship. Mm-hmm. They were not often on the same page. They recognized, though, that they needed each other, but King was determined not to hitch the civil rights movement to whatever movement there was around Lyndon Johnson. Mm-hmm. The civil rights movement was an independent movement. Dr. King's movement was an independent movement. Mm-hmm. And when they had common interests, they worked together. But when they were not on the same page, Dr. King reserved the right to then pressure through organizing, through public action, through nonviolent action, pressure the Johnson administration and the Congress to change their position. Mm-hmm. And I think that is exactly what has to happen with the Obama administration. There needs to be an independent movement.
Yes.
What is interesting, I think the Tea Party teaches us a lesson here, because look at what has happened on the Republican side. The Republican establishment has, for all of the drama that is on the Republican side, yes, they do have principles and so on, but they're essentially in a power game in which, at the end of the day. They will cut deals in order to maintain power and so on. And the Tea Party movement has said, no, wait a minute. We do not accept the old Washington game. We have a basic set of demands. We are organizing independently to make sure that the Republican establishment meets those demands, and the Republican establishment does not meet those demands, we change the Republican establishment. And if you look at what has happened on the budget debate, the establishment politicians said that we will propose about $33, $34, $35 billion worth of budget cuts in the budget, and the Tea Party Republicans in the House said, no, we were elected on a pledge of $100 billion in cuts. And they actually got the Appropriations Committee to go back to the drawing board to come up with a whole different set of cuts.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, this is really true, and I think what you're leading into is very valid in the fact that there is a consistent power block within the Republican Party that makes consistent, concerted demands on its leadership. And I would say that, you know, looking at the Democratic Party, we've seen ever since the president got into office, we've heard various narratives like, wait, he's just been in there a month, he's just been in there a year, give him a chance. And we've seen the progressive wing of the party, in one sense, totally having the door shut on his face by the cabinet insiders in the presidency, and also an endless litany of excuse-making if not outright silence from the progressive community. So how can we expect? Are we not tied by a sort of a guaranteed losing strategy by refusing, by essentially giving a blank check and having a fear?
Well, let me
alienate.
Let me jump in here and saying that this is something that certainly is not new with the Obama administration. I would suggest that beginning in the Clinton era, there has always been that deferring to the business class by the Democratic establishment, and there has been a failure for the last 20, 30 years in terms of the progressive wing to put true pressure on the Democrat establishment.
Well, I would totally agree with that. Right. And how is that going to go forward? And if that's the strategy, if we have a situation where in the existing Obama administration or other Democratic administrations essentially say, well, guess what? You know, you're captive to us. The labor movement's captive to us. All of our voting base is essentially captive to us. And so, whatever deal we cut, that we cut with the Republicans, whatever deal we cut that's congruent with the desires and wishes of our corporate campaign sponsors, you're just going to have to swallow it, and you're going to have to toe the party line, or we're going to hold up this graven image of the Tea Party, and we're going to rattle it every election cycle, and you're just going to have to jump right back in and hold your nose and vote for us and accept. What kind of a recipe is that? Is that a recipe for moving forward towards any sort of a dream of economic justice? Or I don't see the end game in this.
Thank you, caller.
Yeah, let me say two things about that. Number one, I think you have to absolutely stop the evisceration of the union movement, because the union movement right now is the biggest thing that in terms of resources, it's the core of what the progressive movement has and what the progressive movement can tap into in terms of resources for the long-term political fight. Mm-hmm. But the second thing I would say is that progressives themselves need to pay a lot more attention to building infrastructure and devote more money and mind power to developing an infrastructure that moves message, that moves our principles, and then develops and runs candidates. If you look at what exists on the right, they now have a 24/7 cable news network. They have several large think tanks. There are publications that regularly crank out conservative talk points. I point out, just as a small example, here in Washington, D.C., a wealthy conservative billionaire out of Denver bought one of the local suburban community newspapers, and turned it literally into a distribution mechanism for daily right-wing talking points, distributed free at subway stations. That is something that we need to figure out how to match, because their message is getting into the hands of average Americans through cable news, through print publications, through websites, through papers being cranked out by think tanks. And we need to have, at all of those levels, a competing, compelling narrative about what America can be and what America should be.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. Our guest this morning is Isaiah Poole. Let me in, and we're speaking about Martin Luther King and the movement for economic justice today, what we can learn and how we can continue the struggle. Give us a call and participate. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. And we'll go to Joanne.
Good morning.
Yes, hello, Mr. Poole. Bravo for those last, I'm trying not to cry, sentences of yours. And in spite of all the ongoing political chaos, past and present, I want to say this. I can't go to that rally in Portland this afternoon, but I want to say to the spirits of Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X and all like activists, I love your energy, and I feel so bad at what human beings have done to you.
Thank you, Joanne. You are listening to More Talk Radio. And
it's 8:40, and if you'd like to join in the conversation, you have to do so quickly. We're going to give the last few minutes of our show to the speech from King, but we do engage and talk with those who are calling in. Get in now, 503-231-8187. We'll go up. Nope, that was it. That was our last caller. Okay, great. So we have a few minutes here. In terms of the legacy of King to fight and organize toward economic and job security here in the States, his work was not only, well, basically, I want to say it was almost prophetic. It really was prophetic. And it was prophetic in the same vein, I think, if we look at words from Jefferson and even some of our first immigrants who came here fleeing corporations, mm-hmm. and recognizing that within the corporate mindset, there was no place for human dignity or living wage sensibilities. We're trying to recover ground that we've lost, excuse me, either from kind of falling asleep at the wheel collectively or from major damage done to the few gains that we've made. As you've looked at King's work, what would you say he would ask us to do or be aware of now, where we are now, when we've got false statements of budget deficits being attributed to public employees, pensions, and salaries, are false statements as to the need for union organizing to protect jobs or any of the other elements we're saying, what would King tell us to focus on now?
You know what resonates? What resonates to me in King's last speech in Memphis was the discussion of dangerous unselfishness.
Yes.
And what we have now is a battle between those who say that every man is in fact an island. Every man is responsible to stand or fall on his own devices. That we have no real obligations to each other. That the notion of community is something that is an option, but not something that is required of us or should be required of us to move forward. The contrasting vision is the vision of that we are a community, that our fates are intertwined, that none of us can claim to have truly prospered unless all of us are prospering. And that, I think about, I'm going to go into preacher mode, but, you know, one of my favorite passages in Scripture is in 1 Corinthians, where Paul talks about the body and that each organ in the body has a particular function. Mm-hmm. And we cannot be truly whole as a body if one of our parts is misfunctioning.
Yes.
And so the question for us as a society is, can we afford to say to the parts of our body that are not fully whole, because of our economic conditions or whatever the reason may be, can we afford to say to those parts of our body, that's your problem? Or should we be saying as a community, we need to come together, we need to pool our resources, and particularly those of us to whom much has been given, can we step up to the plate and acknowledge that for those of us who have much, much is indeed required? That is the question. I think what King would call us to is the level of unselfishness that would say you know, yes, times are tough, but you know what? Times have always been tough. And what we need to do is recognize that we will not survive for very long. And I really, my fear is that this great country of ours will not be an America that any of us will want to have. If we continue down the path of saying that, you know, it's of individual responsibility and budget cutting and privatization and, that the sort of the conservative mindset that is dominating our politics, and we turn to a more, we need to turn to a more unselfish, dangerously unselfish way of ordering our economic priorities, ordering our political priorities, in order for us to survive as a nation.
Amen.
Thank you. We have another caller online. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Sister Celeste, Brother Cecil, and preacher friend Mr. Poole. Good morning, everybody.
Hey, Bob.
Good morning.
Good morning, good morning. Two statements, and then I have a question or a comment. Another station this morning I was listening to, and they mentioned the question, not so much as who killed Martin Luther King Jr., but what killed Martin Luther King Jr.? Very profound question there. Also, listen to Mr. Poole, dangerous unselfishness. I just heard that term for the first time about 5 minutes ago when he first mentioned it, and I really can understand that to my life, and all of our volunteers at the radio station, of our unselfishness, the time that we give away from our life that we are living to stay afloat, to make enough of a living to make payments for rent and food and groceries. And Mr. Poole, a question about the economicness of the situation with Martin Luther King Jr. I'm lucky enough, or I don't know if I'm lucky enough, but I'm strong enough and profound enough and steadfast enough to have my own business. And, you know, nobody can fire me. And it's up to me on how many hours I work and how much money I make, usually on a daily basis. So, Mr. Poole, what do you think about more people or groups of people, small groups of people, not a whole corporation, start your own business, economic business on yourself, start your own business? And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Well, we have a long tradition in the African-American community of entrepreneurship, and a lot of that was forced on us by segregation. Unfortunately, what has happened in the last two or three decades is an economic consolidation that in part has happened because the whole notion of antitrust has seemed to go out the window. Government should be providing a level playing field or making sure that there's a level playing field so that people, by virtue of their size, cannot just simply block other people who want to come up and be competitors. I think if we want to preserve entrepreneurship in this country, we need to pay real close attention, particularly in the 21st century, to things like the net neutrality debate.
Mm-hmm.
We don't talk about net neutrality, but you know, when you have a situation where the internet, which is now the major conduit, the major highway for setting up new businesses, new enterprises, if you have a situation where a very small number of companies control that pipeline and can then say, we will determine who gets in and who doesn't, and we will determine whether we set higher fences for some people to get in than for others, that's incredibly dangerous. We need to pay particular attention to those debates. and those discussions and get involved in those and say, no, wait a minute. We need a free and open internet, just as we need a free and open private sector that will allow for innovation and creativity, but a federal government that is strong enough to make sure that the playing field is level.
Well, Mr. Poole, we have only touched upon the conversation about the struggle for economic justice. We thank you for sharing your thoughts, and I want to remind our callers about you. And if people want to read more, where may they find you?
We're on ourfuture.org.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you for joining us this morning. We're going to close our program a little bit early so we can hear Dr. King.
Dr. King, and if you've got any closing words, Isaiah, I know you slipped into preacher mode, and that's okay, because today is a good day for exhortation.
You know, King was a prophet, and, you know, he said that he taught us that the most important things is justice, mercy, fairness. And if we cannot pass those tests, are we being just to each other? Are we being fair to each other? Most importantly, are we loving each other? If we are not doing those things, then who are we? We have no claim to greatness if we're not doing those things. I think that's the thing that we need to remember over the next few days. It's not just about whether we make a magic number on the budget or whether we make, a certain policy. Are we doing what, if we claim to have come out of a Judeo-Christian heritage, are we actually doing what that Judeo-Christian heritage calls us to do?
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for troubling the waters. And we'd like to have you come back sometime and chat with us more as we continue this struggle against the eroding experience and condition of the middle class.
Thank you so much. It would be my pleasure.
All right.
Let me remind you that coming up at 9 is the OMO Variety Hour, an interview with David Finkel about the pros and cons on intervening in Libya, review of Sucker Punch, a review of the HBO miniseries Mildred Pierce, and a look at pervasiveness of class struggle in the developed world. At 10 is Air Cascadia. At 10:15, Locus Focus, Changing Planet, Changing Health, a conversation with Dan Ferber. At 11, Dr. David Naiman speaks with a self-defined renegade scientist, Diane Burstford Croker. 11:30, Madness Radio. And we want to thank all of you KBOO members and supporters.
Absolutely. And please, if you can, the rally takes place today at 5:30. It's at Director Park, which is on Yamhill between Park and 9th Avenue. It's a great opportunity to show solidarity and to get fired up about protecting your future, your children's future, and actually even our present. And speaking of wonderful opportunities, be listening to Labor Radio, because there will be a presentation of this Saturday's International Rally. I got a chance to take part of that took place at Peace Arch Park this past Saturday, where we had rallying of unions from Canada, Washington, and Oregon, and solidarity. Stay tuned. We have coming up an excerpt from Dr. King's speech to commemorate our need for ongoing and positive struggle. This has been More Talk Radio on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland.